Well, before you go to the chapel and get married, Kevin McKinley says there are a few financial issues to work out, and we'll talk about those on this week's edition of On Your Money. Good morning. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have any personal finance questions, or maybe you're tying the knot and need to have some financial advice, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. Hey, Kevin.
Hello, random guest host name here.
Hi, Cynthia.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, and you?
I'm good. Happy to be here with you. Well, we've been offering some life and financial advice to those celebrating ceremonies in June, and today we have a new group to address. What would that be, Kevin?
Well, we've already covered graduates of high school and higher education, but today we will be discussing newlyweds, according to the website The Knot. June is still barely the most popular month for weddings, and this can be a time of great happiness, but if you don't go into it for the right reasons and with open eyes, there are some things that can create problems down the road, and this advice may benefit other couples as well, even if you're not getting married today. And because of our elegant, slick radio editing production here, we've been going to tie this subject into our car conversations that we've been having and will be having later on today.
Well, what are some of the bigger issues to discuss?
Let's start with that survey from The Knot that said that the average cost right now of the wedding of the respondents to the survey was $28,000. That's the average cost, $28,000. That's the highest figure since 2008. And if the couples are paying for that themselves and are not already independently wealthy, they may have some immediate money issues. I know a very well-respected, very brilliant therapist who said that she wished all couples would be required to have a premarital discussion where they would discuss sex, money, and the division of household duties and make sure they agreed upon it before the wedding rather than after trying to come to a reconciliation afterward. We're going to cover the money. I do think, though, that that's a great idea to try to agree on big goals in terms of how you're going to spend your time, your money, what kind of work, what kind of life goals you might have, and then whether that's buying a new home, when you're going to have kids, how many you're going to have, what kind of professional goals you're going to have, and set a timeline so that year by year you've said, all right, we kind of have a plan here. And that sounds almost anal or retentive to try to map out your future when you're just, full of wedded bliss. But it can be a way to open up a dialogue between two people who may be either in the dark on what the other one's thinking or not agree with what the other one's thinking.
Hmm. What about spending and saving?
That is a common issue, especially because it is something that we all have as an internal conflict ourselves, and it's quantifiable. You can tell exactly what is being spent and what is being saved, and many successful couples, and by successful, I mean that they get along, that they are stronger together than they would be if they were apart. There is a spender and there is a saver, and it's very hard to reconcile that sometimes if times are tough or there's stress on either one side or both sides of the relationship. So a good way around that is to agree on a discretionary amount that the saver can spend or that the spender can spend on every single week. Let's say it's $25 or $50, and if the spender wants to tear that up into little pieces, he or she can do it. If the spender wants to spend more than that on something, it requires a talk, and the saver in the relationship, if indeed that is the case, has the right to say no. And if the spender says, well, I still want to buy it, then the saver says, then save up your $25 to $50 amounts every week until you can afford to spend it.
That sounds like an allowance.
That's a word we don't like to use because it's a little patronizing, and it makes the saver feel like they're the child in the relationship, and that the spender feel like the child and the saver feels like the parent on it. So allowance is a word we don't like to use. It's more discretionary. It means that the spender gets to use his or her judgment.
Okay. Well, why don't we go over the most important factor again?
Sure. We discussed this last week, and we will be discussing it again often in the future. It is not what you make. It's not how you invest it, and what kind of rate of return you have. Your financial independence and your life happiness depends on what you spend. And cutting spending is much easier than making more money, whether it's on investments or on your own personal income. So the less money you spend, the more likely you'll be able to maintain your freedom and your flexibility in your life to go and do what you want. So especially couples who are starting out, I'd like them to track their spending each month and know where everything is going and then compare and discuss it and sit down and say, okay, we spent this much on groceries. Is that normal? Can we cut it? Or you spent this much on gas. Is there a way to cut that back? And then discuss the progress and the changes. A lot of people keep little spreadsheets or notebooks where they just like to note all those dollar amounts. There usually be one person in the relationship who enjoys this or takes on the task. The other person has to recognize that it is a task and it's not fun, so they have to honor the person's efforts by sitting down and having that discussion, even though they may not necessarily want to.
Hmm. What does marital bliss have to do with driving?
Well, we have some good and bad news. As we mentioned, we are going to be discussing car insurance rates down the road. Insure.com did a survey of married couples and found that about a third of in the couples, a partner may lie to the other one about a ding in the car, saying, I have no idea how that got there, knowing full well that the person was at fault. A quarter may lie about getting a ticket or getting into an accident. And about 20% may not tell the other partner if he or she forgot to send in the check for the car insurance premium. Now, that's the bad news.
Okay.
But we have good news for it. Professor of psychology at the University of Rochester surveyed couples to find out what really made them happy in a relationship. And the most appreciated gestures by the couples were not roses or cards or big declarations of love or lifetime of eternal support. They were the little things like making the bed or taking the trash out without being asked. And most importantly, filling up the other partner's gas tank, which I don't think that's a euphemism. I think they actually mean taking that person's car to the station and putting gasoline in it and paying for it and then bringing it home again.
I'm really glad you clarified that.
Thank you.
Well, if you have a question for Kevin McKinley, maybe how to save money for your wedding or your honeymoon, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin McKinley does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their personal advisors prior to making any investment decisions. It's time to dip into the On Your Money mailbag, and a listener named Jeff says, Hi, Kevin. I enjoy listening to your show on WPR. I inherited part of an IRA and am going to begin receiving small, regular distributions from the account. How do I decide if I should have income tax withheld? Does it pay on such a small amount, and what are the criteria for making this decision? Thanks for your very informative radio show and for any assistance you're able to provide concerning my inquiries.
Jeff, very wise to not only include the false praise, but to bookend the question front and back. In case I've forgotten about the false praise at the front, comes slamming in right at the end with more false praise to make sure the question gets on the air, and it worked. This is usually an issue with income that doesn't come from an employer's paycheck. Like if you're self-employed or you're getting distributions from an IRA like Jeff or Social Security or pension, and it's taxable income, the IRS wants the money sooner rather than later, first of all, because they need it for the government. And second of all, they want to make sure that you still have it rather than when April 15th rolls around, you say, oh, I know I owe taxes on this, but I just don't have the money. So the withholding is required at certain amounts and at certain levels of income.
Hmm. Well, what happens if the recipient doesn't designate a portion of the payments to go directly to taxing authorities?
Usually, nothing at first, and it depends on the amount. But eventually, it may trigger a need for the quarterly estimates of taxes, meaning that if the IRS gives us and says, hey, you received a bunch of income last year and you should have been withholding some taxes from it, this year you have to file quarterly estimates of taxes based on what you think your income and income taxes will be. Then you have to calculate it, and it can be a big hassle. And if you miss the payments, you can get a small penalty, but it's still one more hassle on top of the bigger hassle of already paying your taxes and then having to add quarterly estimates and calculation on top of it.
So what do you suggest to Jeff?
I think Jeff should go with the withholding. I think you should err on the side of caution, too. Typically, you want to withhold a rate at which you think you'll be taxed at on the top side. And for most people, that's usually 25% at the federal rate and maybe 5 to 6% for state income tax rate as well. And again, this makes it more likely that he'll not only have to file quarterly estimates in the future, but also he may get some money back at April 15th, which is a nice, pleasant surprise, rather than finding out he has to pay in.
Well, thank you for that email, Jeff. And if you'd like to email Kevin, you can send your questions to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also call in right now with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234 to have your personal financial questions answered by Kevin McKinley. Jan in Chippewa Falls joins us next, Kevin. Hi, Jan.
Hi. My husband's sister passed away recently. And she had a lot of bonds, and my husband is the one listed as on POD, and he is not the executor of the estate, and the will states the bonds. The will states that things are to be divided among six siblings. How do we go about this?
Has there been any discussion so far as to who wants which bond, Jen?
No.
Okay.
There are a lot of bonds.
A lot of bonds. Well, there are a few ways you can go about this. You can pick and choose if you can all come to an agreement for it, but it's difficult looking at a brokerage account statement to know which bonds are good and which ones aren't. You can liquidate the whole thing, but some of those bonds might actually be desirable. The easiest and cleanest way to do it is just to liquidate the whole thing and then send cash to each one of the beneficiaries. But if you can get some kind of analysis, are the bonds held like at a brokerage account or some kind of a financial advisor's?
No. No.
Okay. Did she hold them like in a safe deposit box?
Yes.
Okay. I actually would take them to some kind of financial advisor to have a list of the bonds looked at and say which ones would I want if I were to receive some of these. Which ones would I keep? In part because you know you can always sell them eventually if you want, but if you hang on to them. And they fit into your portfolio, and they're good for you rather than good for your dear departed sister-in-law. It's difficult to replace those bonds easily, and in part because when you buy and sell bonds, or when they're bought and sold for you, there's a pretty big spread that can make a big difference in the value. Meaning, if it's kind of like buying and selling cars, that there could be several thousand dollars between what you pay for a car from the dealer, let's say, than what you would get if you were to turn around and trade that car in right away the moment after you bought it, and that can often be 2 or 3% of the face value of the bond, and which then can change things drastically. So I would have them take them to some kind of advisor, contact your CPA if you don't have one, and see if he or she can recommend one that you go to, and just say, look at these bonds. Is there ones we'd want to keep? And again, as a default, the best thing to do is just liquidate the whole portfolio, convert it all to cash, and then divvy up the checks amongst the six beneficiaries.
Sound good, Jan?
Okay, and then how do we deal with the taxes, because if he cashes these in, then there would be taxes on what was earned.
Sure. Are they savings bonds or are they just normal? I'm sorry.
Series E.
No, they are savings bonds. Okay, yeah, that is important because now you have to a lot more work done. And so the savings bonds are a different animal than the bonds I was referring to. That go to treasurydirect.gov, and you'll find out not only what the bonds, each one of the bonds are worth, but you can also see which bonds are still paying interest and see what the tax liability is. And generally, inheriting these bonds means that the estate does owe the taxes on it once they're cashed in. But there's some different speculation that you might want to look at in terms of, does this still a pretty good bond and if it's paying interest, because some of those Series E bonds had a fixed rate that was guaranteed and might be actually a pretty competitive rate. So go to treasurydirect.gov. We'll put that link up at onyourmoney.com later on today so you can find it.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC, and this is On Your Money. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money. If you have any questions for Kevin McKinley, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. 1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Kevin, we have Jeff in Eau Claire on the line. Hi, Jeff.
Hi.
What's your question?
Pretty good. I have a question about postnuptial agreements. I was wondering, what can I put on a postnuptial agreement in Wisconsin, and what do I have to do to make sure that it works when I need it?
Postnuptials are very tricky, and you should definitely contact an attorney, but you usually have to get the, what would it be, the nuptee? Is that proper? To agree to it as well. And usually if you have a reason for doing it, there may be a reason that the other partner may not want to agree to, at least onto your terms for it. So I don't think it's a bad idea. I think it's a very, I think prenuptials and postnuptials represent a realistic view of life, which things change, relationships change, people change, and sometimes there are things that need to be done to satisfy one or both parties in a relationship, whether that's business or romantic or emotional. And I'm sorry for you 21-year-olds who are toting around 5-pound copies of Bride magazine right now planning your nuptials, but this kind of stuff happens. But I definitely would contact an attorney first and say, here's what I want to accomplish. What is the most fair and equitable way to everyone involved to try to accomplish this, and then see what the attorney says, and then go back to the intended party and say, all right, I need to do this, here's why I need to do this, and here's what I'd like you to do, and see what happens.
Okay, thanks.
Good luck.
Thanks, Jeff. Kent emails, I have an inheritance and want to buy some property out of state. What's a good way to make a cash offer on a property to get a good deal? Would refinancing that amount be a way to go, or would a home equity loan be the way to proceed?
To actually get the price or to get the property at a certain price, I would say the cash offer is the strongest offer, because with all the contingencies involved in purchasing a property, it's nice for the seller to know, hey, this person has a check who can hand it over the minute we reach a deal, in theory. And then if Kent wants to and finds that he needs to, he can go back and refinance the property at the same time. And then at that point, I would much prefer him to have a loan against that property first rather than taking out against his own home and jeopardizing potentially ownership of his home.
All right. Thanks for that email, Ken. If you'd like to call Kevin McKinley, we are here till 9 o'clock. The number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email onyourmoney@wpr.org. We've got Brenda in Appleton next. Hi, Brenda.
Hi.
What's your question today?
Hi, my mother, I'm just looking for some advice on my mother. She was recently divorced from my father, 44 years, and she's leaving the marriage with $350,000 from a shared Ameriprise fund. She'll be getting $780 a month alimony and $600 a month Social Security when that kicks in. She's 64 years old. She would like to retire right now. She has a meeting with a credit union tonight, and I'm not sure if that's – I just want to give her some informative suggestions of how she should invest that money.
Yeah, you're a very kind daughter, Brenda, to take the time to look out for your mother's interest, especially when this is a time where anybody in their 60s who's thinking about retiring is concerned enough, and especially when she's going through this big change, which happens. But it's very unfortunate usually when it does happen, but I'm glad that you're looking out for her. Offhand advice, without knowing her or talking to her, is to err on the side of caution when she's investing. One of the bigger concerns I have when people are making these kinds of transitions is that it's not only frightening to lose your job and your income, it's frightening to lose your partner for many people. And this vulnerable situation she's in can be made worse if, for some reason, the investments she's in crater and she loses, 30 or 40% of the value, which can happen. It will happen at some point, and it can happen. Regardless, the more risky the investment is, the more likely it is to happen. So I would have her sit down with a credit union, and I would have her start building up some money in a liquid account like CDs or even just a regular checking account, maybe a year to 2 years worth of living expenses, and siphon that off of her more aggressive investments so that if something does happen where the markets go down or the value of her account drops a lot, she still knows that she has enough money on hand to cover herself for 2 years while she waits to figure out what to do with the investments, if anything, or waits for them to come back, which hopefully they eventually will.
Okay. All right. She has no debt. She left the homes and everything. She has no credit card, no medical bill. She's in fairly relatively good health. Is a credit union a good place for her to dump this money?
We don't like to use the word dump in the financial advisory business, Brenda. But, I would say in a credit union where they do actually respect her, if she says she wants a CD or money market account, they don't try to sell her anything else. It's not that credit unions themselves are inherently prone to do that. It's just a lot of financial institutions don't make as much money off of checking accounts and saving accounts and CDs as they do by selling other investment products. So at this time in her life, I'd prefer she have a bunch of money, $50,000 or $100,000, just sitting still, not making anything, but not losing anything for the time being. And most credit unions are great places to start for that.
Thanks for your call, Brenda. If you have a personal finance question for Kevin McKinley, maybe you've got a question about your 401k or your mortgage, how to save money for a wedding or a big trip, well, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234 or email onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin, we've got an email from Rita. She says, I'm a homeowner and have always believed that I should have cash ready in the event there is a furnace breakdown or roof needed or some other emergency. She currently has $17,000 sitting in her savings account and wants your opinion regarding how much money should be available and when she should start shifting money into her investment accounts instead of the savings account. She saves about $1,000 a month. What's your advice?
Good for you, Rita. excuse me. I think it relates back to the Brenda's question about her mother. I'd like to see Rita keep at least 6 months to a year's worth of living expenses set aside in that account, and not just for emergencies, but just for other expenditures that come up. Because one thing that can happen is we've been in a very low interest rate environment, and recently anyway, a fairly lenient lending environment, and it's difficult to see that continuing forever. And if interest rates go up, or if lenders become more strict again and to whom they will lend money, she'll be very glad she has a bunch of cash set aside. And I get very concerned, especially when markets are really near their high prices rather than their low, when people saying, I need to get this out of the money market and making some money, because as we've seen in just the past week or two here, you can lose as much money as you can make. And oftentimes the losses come more swiftly and painfully than the gains come. And so I would tell her to keep at least a year of living expenses set aside. And that's also a very valuable exercise, because it forces people to add up their living expenses and see where their money is actually going.
Thanks for that email, Rita. It's time for Smart Assets, and the chairman of the Federal Reserve mentioned that he might be taking away the punch bowl, and the investment party came to a halt. What happened, Kevin?
Yeah, it was just almost like the in a movie where the music's just, you know, the scratches on the record, which people don't really use anymore. But Ben Bernanke is the chairman of the Federal Reserve, and his job is basically to try to maintain stable prices and low unemployment. And to that end, the Federal Reserve has been buying bonds, treasury bonds and mortgage bonds, to the tune of about $85 billion every single month, and in a goal to stabilize the financial system, to boost the economy. And then other central bankers around the world have followed suit in other countries. They've also taken measures in their own country to buy bonds, buy assets, make money flow more freely, and keep interest rates low.
How has that been working out?
Well, since 2008, if you own pieces of paper or things, it's actually worked out pretty well. Low interest rates have pushed many big investors into other kinds of investments, boosting up those prices like stocks and bonds and commodities and gold. And even housing has finally seen some rise in prices. Some of the numbers we're seeing in the index numbers even today are up about 10 or 12% over the past month or the past year. Others are not seeing quite the benefit, especially on Main Street. Unemployment was 4.5% before the economic crisis in 2008, went up to about 10%, and it's still about 7.5%. And wages just recently turned back up in the growth rate a little bit, but they've been decelerating quite a bit over the last several years. And the cost of living for workers and all the rest of us have gone up, in part because there's been a lot of speculation on the raw commodities that are used to make the products that we want and need to buy.
So what happened last week?
The chairman, Ben Bernanke, mentioned that he may ease the bond buying a little bit later this year and used a word called taper, which is sounds like a real gradual phrase, but it scared the heck out of investors. Stocks dropped about 5%. Gold dropped $1,400 an ounce down to below $1,300 an ounce. And then bonds fell in price and interest rates rose. The 10-year Treasury, which until a little while ago was 1.63% on the 10-year Treasury yield, jumped up to 2.64%. That's the highest yield in 2 years. And then more importantly to a lot of homeowners and home sellers out there, mortgage rates rose from about 3.95% on average to 4.4% on the average 30-year fixed rate, according to Bankrate.com.
What's your advice for worried investors?
Keep in mind, we are still near highs, not near the lows. And even with these recent declines, we're back to about April or May in most asset prices here. If you need growth in your money and you can handle drops of anywhere from 20 to 50% in the value and you won't be needing the money to spend anytime soon, it's still okay to be a long-term investor and maybe even reallocate some money into these assets at their slightly lower prices. Otherwise, if you don't fit into all of these categories, you should be concerned more about the return of your principal rather than the return on your principal.
I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine, and that's Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. This is On Your Money. You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email onyourmoney@wpr.org. Next, we'll talk to Dick in Manitowish Waters. Hi, Dick.
Hi there.
Morning,
questioning
Dick.
Good morning. I am questioning when you have a chunk of money with a financial company. I know that they have to make a living. They've got to take a percentage. But as you get older, it seems like you're on a 50-50 allocation. Do they still take? Do they take that percentage, the hidden costs and everything, out of the total assets or out of the 50? How does that work out of 50-50? Because bonds probably don't pay. Some of those bonds aren't paying as much as the financial cost would be. And what is, with the hidden costs, what are the financial costs that you get from a typical financial advisor?
These are great questions. Are you talking about the mutual fund costs themselves, or is this the cost of the
advisor? No, I'm talking about when you allocate a certain amount of dollars to a firm, and they invest that for you on a basis, and, on a fifth allocation of 50-50, let's say.
Okay.
Bonds, and then the rest are in stocks.
You bring up a good point in that, you can't, let's say an investment advisor charges 1%, or even a bond mutual fund costs 1% a year, which neither one of those things are uncommon. You may make less than 1% on that particular bond, and you may even lose money on it. And so you can't gauge the value of the service on the investment return. You have to be getting something intangible from that relationship, whether it's comfort that it's somebody else's problem, or you're getting advice on other issues in your financial life, like life insurance or debt payment or whatever. Just the investment return cannot be the specific goal, because if you'd have put money with a financial advisor a week ago in some kinds of investments, you might have lost 5% already, and they're still going to charge you that 1% or so. So you have to look at the relationship and say, am I getting value of this from this relationship that's above and beyond just the investment return, whether or not, because they can't invest the money just to try to make more than enough of what you return. You can evaluate it from that. You can say, well, these people aren't making me any more money than I could on my own, and I'm not getting anything else from the service, therefore I'm not going to pay them my 1% or whatever year. And in terms of cost, you're probably going to pay anywhere from 0.5% to 2% per year to an investment firm to invest your money for you. And so that can be a pretty significant amount, and especially if you don't feel like you're getting anything else from it.
You did well.
Finally, for once in my life.
Thank you, Dick.
Thanks, Dick. Seth in Chicago emails, how important is it that your financial advisor is a fiduciary to ensure that they are working in your best interest?
Yeah, that's kind of an inside baseball issue right now. Many advisors out there, there are many very good advisors out there who are not fiduciaries. And there are some who aren't so good who are fiduciaries. But generally, a fiduciary is a legal definition that means that the advisor has to work in the client's interest first, meaning he or she has to recommend what he or she thinks is best for the client, even if it means that he or she is not going to make money off of it. Advisors who aren't fiduciaries are more obligated to recommend things that are appropriate for the investor, which, again, can still be very good, but it doesn't necessarily hold them to the same legal standard of a fiduciary investor, and or a fiduciary advisor, rather. And some advisors say, I don't want to be held to that standard. I don't think it's right or fair. And other people say, no, I'm very proud to be held to that higher standard, and I intend to obligate it.
All right. Well, we've got Louise in Wautoma on the line next. Hi, Louise.
Hi. My question is, I'm thinking about putting an addition on my home, and I'm wondering what's the best way to do it. I could pay cash for the addition. I could get a home equity loan, or I could get what my bank calls a guaranteed loan where I put my money aside. And I'm wondering which of the three options is the best one.
The guaranteed loan, Louise, probably has a lower rate or maybe a fixed rate that the home equity line of credit doesn't have. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. I kind of like that guaranteed deal for a couple of reasons. One is if you take the home equity line of credit out, that has a floating interest rate. And if the interest rates rise, you're going to have to pay a higher interest rate or pay the thing off. With the guaranteed one, the money is more likely to be repaid because the bank knows where it's at, and therefore you get a lower interest rate for it. And I like having, when interest rates are low, which they're still extremely low right now, I like having a fixed rate on there so you know what the cost is going to be. And then if you ever decide you really just need to pay it off, you can go ahead, slide the cash over, and be done with it. But in the meantime, you are adding value to the home, Louise. You know, you're as you probably are aware, putting money into a home improvement, first of all, it's always a question of when you do it, not if you do it. You always have to improve a home if you own it for a long time. And the second thing is your net worth does not decrease by the amount of the improvement. It's only a portion of that you lose out because now the house is worth more. And more importantly, you get to enjoy the improvements you've made to it while you're still living in the house. So I think it's a great idea to do it, and I like your third option there if you agree.
The question is it still tax deductible?
That's a good question. I would check with your accountant on it. The home equity line of credit is tax deductible. There's probably a difference between the amount of interest charged by the lending institution and whatever they're paying you on the guaranteed amount that can be tax deductible. But I would check with both the lender and an accountant on your specific details to make sure.
Thanks for that call, Louise. 1-800-642-1234 is the number to call if you have a question for Kevin McKinley. You can also email onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Joy Cardine. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is On Your Money on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Joy Cardine. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. He's here to give you financial advice. We've been discussing all the various costs that go into owning and driving a vehicle, and today we'll finish up with another annoying but necessary expense. What would that be, Kevin?
It's insurance, and it's not only annoying, but it is required in the state of Wisconsin. According to AAA, your cost of driving survey in 2012, the average vehicle owner paid 7 cents per mile for driving, and your cost may vary based on your vehicle and your driving history and your driving habits. But Insure.com says that Wisconsin has the 10th cheapest average car insurance rates in the country at $1,228 on average. High is Louisiana and the low is Maine. And let me just say, based on the other states down near the bottom in cost with the rest of us in Wisconsin, the more boring a state you live in, the less you will probably pay for car insurance.
How do we reduce what we're paying on our current policy?
The first thing is actually to contact your current insurance provider and say, here's, you know, my life right now, and I want to know if is there a way I can reduce what I'm currently paying. You can raise the deductible, taking it from $250 up to $1,000 will cut your premium by about 25 to 30%. You can combine the auto policy with other ones at the same insurer, like homeowners insurance or liability. If you had a teen driver in the house and you never called the insurance agent and said, "Hey, this kid's gone and not using the car anymore," lower my premiums because we are less risky now as a household. You can also maintain a very high credit score. That's one factor that's used to determine auto insurance premiums. And some companies, check with the company to see if this is the case, have a deal where if you take some kind of safe driver course, they will cut your premium five to ten percent. Now it depends on the actual company and the state on which you live, but if you can knock a few hundred bucks off your annual cost by just taking an online course, it's a good deal.
If that doesn't help cut our car costs,
you might want to shop around, and especially if you haven't done so in the last 5 or 10 years, which most of us hasn't. Some of the companies that have a higher customer satisfaction rate include USAA. You may not qualify to get the auto insurance from them, but if you do, they are very competitive and also have a high customer satisfaction rate for people getting paid when they expect to be paid. But there are a couple different websites you can go to as well to compare policies and providers. One is ratekick.com. And then the insurer Progressive.com is confident enough that they'll offer a good deal. They encourage people to go to Progressive.com, and anonymously you can put in your some of your data and check to see the issues of other kinds of insurers out there. So RateKick.com or Progressive.com, and we'll put direct links up to those websites at our website, OnYourMoney.com, later on today.
What about avoiding a big bump in premiums in the future?
Well, first of all, don't make claims, especially for little things like little nicks and dings that that might only cost you, you know, $50 or $100. You might be better off just paying those out of pocket. But also, don't get in trouble. If you get a speeding ticket, you can probably see your premiums go up 10 to 15%. Reckless driving, 20%. A DUI can be 20% as well. And you can research the next car that you buy to find out if it's the kind of car where it generally generates higher insurance premiums than another comparable car. And so in 2 weeks, when we return from our brief but well-deserved vacation, we are going to be covering how to finally buy a new car and what you should look for in such a model.
Sounds great. Looking forward to it. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine. That's Kevin McKinley, and this is On Your Money. We've got Larry in Oak Creek waiting to talk to you. Hi, Larry.
Hello. Hey, I have a question for Kevin. I'm going to be retiring here in July 1st. I have a retirement program, a cash balance, or I can take it as an annuity. I also have a 401k program. I'm going to be checking with an advisor here on different options, but I was wondering, what I'd like to do is take the cash and then invest it, pay off a couple of credit card debts that I have, and then invest the rest. I would like Kevin's thoughts on that.
Yeah, this is a great question, Larry, and I appreciate you calling. The issue with the pension is that, and I don't mean that there's any malfeasance or lies going on here, but the numbers that typically are quoted by any pension provider and saying, hey, you can either take this check, big lump sum, or you can take a little bit every single month. The little bit every single month is usually paid out at a rate that almost seems too good to be true. Meaning that, hey, if I probably live as long as I'm probably going to live and they pay me this check, I'll make way more eventually by the pension than I would if I were to just take the lump sum. And the reason it seems too good to be true is it probably is. Many of those pensions are predicated on an investment return rate of somewhere from 6 to 8% per year, which I don't even know if that's possible if the money is fully invested in, let's say, the stock market. And I definitely don't think it's possible if it's spread between a mix of stocks and bonds and cash. And so it wouldn't be surprising to me at some point if down the road the company said, you know what, Larry, we love your work here, et cetera, but we really can't keep kicking in enough money to support this pension because we haven't been making enough money in our, on the investments within it. Therefore, we're either going to give you a lump sum or take a cut, or we're going to turn your amount over to the Pension Benefit and Guarantee Association, which is then going to cut your benefit as well if the taxpayers won't kick in to make up the difference. So if you want to kind of gamble, and it sounds strange to say this about a pension payment, but if you want to gamble, you may actually want to leave it with the company and see if they actually can honor the obligations, especially since you have other assets on hand that you can invest, like your 401k. But if you say, you know what, I'd rather just have this money where I can see it, where I can do with it what I want, where I can spend it whenever I want, and it's most importantly, I have total control over it, it might be better off just to take the lump sum. And again, at this point in your life and in this point in the world, keeping at least a good chunk of those assets safe is very important.
Thanks for that call, Larry. We'll go next to Bob in Summit Lake. Hi, Bob.
Hi. There's a couple of things that I would like for him to speak to. One of them is investing in a drip program, like with I'm involved with a company with the initials TEG. That's a stock symbol. It's a power company, and I put the money into American Stock Transfer, and I have a choice. I can just roll over the dividends and leave them there, or I can take the dividends either way. But it pays about 5%, and I would like for him to talk with, either the upside or the downside of doing this sort of thing and living on about 90% of what you're taking in for income.
I think those can be a great deal, and especially when it comes to utilities, because utility prices, share prices can go up, can go down. Those dividends can be raised, but they can also be lowered as well. But they have a more consistent business model than most other companies that are available to be purchased in this manner. Two problems with it. One is that if you do this outside of an IRA, you have to account for each one of those quarterly purchases. And so if you ever have to sell it, you have to either sell the whole thing or you have to use specific identification methods, LIFO, FIFO, whatever have you, for the specific shares. So it can create a tax nightmare. So I'm a proponent of the strategy, but I like to have it done in an IRA or a Roth IRA so that if you do need the money at some point down the road or you just don't like the investment and want to go someplace else, you can sell it. And first of all, there's no tax implications to selling it as long as it's inside the Roth IRA or the IRA. But more importantly, you don't have to go back and sort through all the paperwork to try to figure out which statement and which cost basis was sold there. Now, if you're very diligent about it, you can keep that yourself, but it still can make for a nightmare, especially if you only want to sell a portion of it. But otherwise, I do think it's a great way to build up wealth, and especially if you're a very long-term investor, because if those dividends are being reinvested, you don't count on that income coming in, you don't spend it, and it hopefully leads to more shares and more dollar value down the road.
Okay. And thanks, Bob. We've got Sandy in Pewaukee next. Hi, Sandy.
Hi. I was just wondering, Kevin, if I put all my money in with a financial organization and I'm living off the premiums, and I'm not able to put any more money into it right now, but I never hear from my advisor. Shouldn't I be called in for a yearly consult? And if not, should I try to find a different advisor?
I think that, yeah, you should be contacted if there's something comes up. But you also, if it's a kind of relationship where you were expecting to be in semi-regular conversation, you should contact them and say, hey, I'd like to sit down and talk with you. And usually advisors are, it's a problem only if the advisor says no, or if the advisor says yeah, and then you never still get to see him, or doesn't respond to your emails or your contacts whatsoever. So if there's something, do you get the money? Is it like an annuity that you took, like you put the money in and it's immediate annuity? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. That's one of the issues with an immediate annuity is you sure can check with the advisor, but if the advisor is fee-based and somehow you're paying him or her a fee, then yes, you should definitely expect some type of regular conversation. But if all you have with that advisor is the immediate annuity, One of the problems is he or she is not going. He or she made some commission off of that sale, or whoever sold it to you when you first took it out, and now they're not going to make any commission off of you unless you make other kinds of investments with them, and therefore there's no financial incentive for them other than being good people to try to keep you happy and keep you updated on a regular basis. But I think you have the right to call them up and say, hey, I put this money in. Will you sit down and talk with me about this? And if not, I'll go look for somebody else who will.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks for your call, Sandy. 1-800-642-1234. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine, and Kevin McKinley is with us for On Your Money. Kent in Monroe, you're next. Hi, Kent.
Okay. Yep. Hi.
What's your question? You're on the air. What's your question?
My wife and I listen to Kevin's show every week, and we really appreciate his professionalism. You know, last week, Ben Bernanke had some comments that sent the market swooning, and I know he did address that somewhat, but we have a substantial amount of our 401k and 403b funds that are in long-term U.S. Treasury bond funds. So to limit our losses with the equity markets right now, we're wondering, would it decrease our risk if we would move those funds to like a money market?
That's a great question, Kent, and thank you for your kind words, by the way, inaccurate as though they may be. The problem, there's twofold problem here. One is with Treasury bonds. A lot of people think Treasury bonds are safe, and the bonds themselves, they are. But as we've become aware in the last few days, in a mutual fund, the values can swing wildly, and it doesn't take a whole lot of sellers to drive the price down and drive the value down of the mutual fund shares. And mutual funds do not have the same luxury that individual investors have when they own bonds. They cannot just sit with those bonds and hold them to maturity and know that that everybody will get their money back. They may have to sell the bonds at a lower price when people are redeeming shares of the mutual fund, which exacerbates the problem because people are unhappy with the fund for whatever reason. So they sell the shares, and then eventually if the mutual fund managers aren't getting enough new money in, they have to sell bonds at deflated prices or lower prices as well. Money markets have their own issues, one of which is right now there's a lot of discussion about money market providers, and there's about $3 trillion in these money markets, having to start use them like price them like mutual funds, which they can also rise and fall in value. The 2008 financial crisis was really triggered by redemptions in money market funds, and the money market providers did not have enough money to pay off all of the people redeeming, so they had to close them down, and people rightfully panicked and kind of created a run on these things, which then created the problem. If you said we want to keep the money relatively safe and relatively liquid, what's a better alternative? I would much rather see you, Kent, put the money into 3-month, 6-month, 1-year CDs, ladder them out. Again, you're not going to get very much yield on it, but you have the backing of the FDIC insurance on those. And more importantly, you know exactly where the money is. You know exactly what you're going to get on a specific date. And you'll probably end up earning quite a bit more return on those than you would if you were to leave it in the money market account.
Thanks for that call, Kent. We have one last email. Ed in Menominee emails. I'm 60 and recently switched jobs but kept my 401k with my old employer's plan because I was not vested in my new plan for 2 years. Should I roll my old plan into my new plan with the new employer or invest in a third-party investor?
I'm okay with rolling the plan into the new employer's just for convenience and just knowing where everything is. As long as Ed is happy and comfortable with the investment options offered by the new employer. If the investment options are good, he can get this at relatively low cost. Usually he doesn't have to pay an advisor for it. But the bad news about it is he's limited to the, say, dozen or so investment options that are typical in most employer-provided plans. If he does move it over to a third-party investor, an advisor, even a credit union or bank, he can buy a CD, he can buy money market account, or he can put it in one of 7,000 different mutual funds or tens of thousands of stocks and bonds rather than keep it limited. So for convenience sake, if it's allowed, it's okay to move it over to the new employer. And especially if that new employer has a loan provision on the 401k, that's one nice thing about it. You can't technically borrow against an IRA, but you can borrow against many 401ks. And for some people, that's enough reason to have the money in there instead of their own IRA.
Well, Kevin, it's time for the website of the week. What is it?
Well, we've been talking a lot about insurance and how to save money on it. One of the best ways to do that is to get an independent insurance agent. So if you go to IIABA.net and they have an agent locator there, you can look for an independent insurance agent who will shop for you on your behalf and choose from many different companies. And again, we'll have that website up at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Sounds great. Four words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
That's Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network. I hope you'll join us tomorrow at this time. We'll talk about the Astronauts' Wives Club, how the ladies married to the first Mercury 7 banded together to support one another while their husbands were in space. That's tomorrow at this time. Thanks to Bill Martins for production and Christy Taylor for on-air production. This is the Ideas Network.